Ladies and gentlemen, let's get started. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and thanks for coming out today. I appreciate so many of you taking an interest in tonight's event and presentation. We are very honored to have with us tonight a special guest who is our who will be our lead presenter, and is here more to talk with residents of our area in general than to talk with the board for tonight. So we look forward to a time, an opportunity for some interaction between all of those of you who come out tonight and our guest, rather than merely between the Board of Aldermen and our guest. He will be here tomorrow as well, meeting more directly with the Board of Aldermen and with more of an opportunity to talk with us tomorrow. But tonight he's here to present to all of you and to have some interaction with all of us. Mr. Michael Schumann, our guest, is an attorney and economist. He went to school, both undergrad and to law school at Stanford University, and lives in the Washington, D.C. area now. He is a noted grassroots economic development advocate and expert. He's perhaps the, to my way of thinking, at least the foremost expert on the question of building local economies. He's the author of 7 books, including one that is for sale tonight outside a local organization called the Alliance for Community Economics is selling this book, The Small Mart Revolution, for $10 out in the hallway as I'm standing. So you can see Sally Gerner, who is out there. And his most recent previous book was Going Local, Creating Self-Reliant Communities in a Global Age. He has been published in The Nation, The Weekly Standard, The New York Times, and has been in The Washington Post, and has been a periodic commentator on National Public Radio. We're very excited to have him with us here tonight. I hope you all will join me in welcoming Mr. Michael Schumann.
All right. Thank you. Well, it's great to be here, and thank you so much for inviting me to share a little bit of time and some ideas with all of you. I had meant, since you are the mayor with the hat, I had meant to bring my hat, and it's in my car, of the Keep Austin Weird, which is just, so it may be one of the themes we want to come to tonight. I have titled what I wanted to share with you over the next half hour or so, Relentlessly Local, because one of the things that happens is when you work with these folks here, they want you to be fully informed. And that means destroying massive numbers of forests and getting several tens of pounds of materials. And as I've gone through it, there's many interesting reflections on this town, many studies that have been done. But one of the most interesting phrases that came up from one of the groups of people who were focusing on the town was, this is a community that is relentlessly local in its self-image and in its views, and this is the kind of community that we want to retain and grow. Let's see, so I'm gonna, actually, if I go back here, I don't have to mess with that. I will have to. Down. Okay. So, my mission impossible, is consistent with a study that is on the table from RTS Associates, a local Carborough analytical firm, and many other Carborough goals that have been stated, to see if I can offer some thoughts about how we can improve our framework for economic development and how we can improve a kind of to-do list of what economic development should be all about here. For me, the starting place of thinking about economic development is that there's a massive wrestling bout these days between two archetypes of capitalism, Tina and Lois. Tina comes from Maggie Thatcher's Schmidt's invocation, there is no alternative to the global economy, T-I-N-A. And I think it's fair to say that economic developers around the country have embraced TINA with three mantras. The first is get Toyota or any other outsider businesses to locate in your community. Second, prioritize export-led development. And third, reassure your local business community that this is in their interest. Lois is, in my view, the alternative. That is not a Lois, that is Jane Jacobs, the intellectual godmother of many of these ideas. And Lois stands for locally owned and import substituting development. And out of the ideas of Lois have emerged a national movement for local living economies. I am on the board of an organization called BALE, Business Alliance for Local Living Economies. BALE at this point has 45 chapters, all formed since, I think, 2001, representing several tens of thousands of local businesses. And these chapters are really all coalescing around, I think, three central ideas for what they want to do to move their local economies in a development trajectory that's consistent with good quality of life. And so the first is focusing relentlessly local on locally owned businesses. Second, to remember that the strongest economy is one that is simultaneously as self-reliant as possible and has very strong export links. And I think one of the mistakes that's made in the conventional economic development literature is the belief that if you just focus on the export side, the local piece will take care of itself. But in fact, in my view, and I think the view of a growing number of economists, the causality works the other direction, that if you focus on the local side, the export-led side will take care of itself. And finally, there's the living piece of local living economies, which is socially responsible businesses, high labor, and environmental standards. So tonight I'm going to be talking about why we want to embrace Lois. Tomorrow, we're going to be sort of brainstorming a little bit on a kind of to-do list for all of that. But I'm happy in our discussion to talk about some of those to-dos, and I think many of them will be pretty obvious from what I'm going to mention. There are three big reasons why Lois is a much better way of thinking about economic development than TINA is. One of the things that I've tried to do as a way of, if nothing else, keeping myself intellectually honest, is I try to engage TINA advocates with debates around the country. And so this comes from a debate that I did with the head of economic development for Lane County, Oregon, 4 years ago, a fellow named Jack Roberts. And I was very lucky because just prior to our debate, the local newspaper published the record of 5 years of economic development that he had done, and he was largely administering a system of tax abatements. 95% of those tax abatements went to six non-local businesses. Three came, took the abatements, and within a year or two, left. Two came, took the abatements, and more, you know, stuck around the jobs that they promised. And one was somewhat on target. The other 5% of the tax abatements went to about 100 local businesses, locally owned businesses, that made very modest promises and by and large kept them. And the bottom line was stunning, because in tax abatement terms, the cost of a job for Lois was $2,000. The cost per job of all the jobs that TINA produced was about $22,000 a job. And in net terms, because many of these jobs came and went, it was over $60,000 a job. So it was 20 times more expensive to do economic development with recruitment than it was to do it growing your own local businesses, Was that just an accident? I don't think so. There are several characteristics of local businesses that make them exceptional building blocks for economic development. The first is that local businesses don't move. They do not have big plans for going to Malaysia or China. Because they don't move, they become long-term producers of wealth. So this is kind of my exhibit A of this point. This is a cheesehead. This is a rabid fan of the Green Bay Packers. And the Green Bay Packers are important because they're the only team in the National Football League not owned by a single obnoxious individual. So all of the other NFL teams, you know, they play games. You don't build me a stadium. You don't give me a couple of tens of millions of dollars of extra money. We're out of here. Art Modell took his Cleveland Browns to Baltimore. Well, there will never be Baltimore Packers because the Packers formed themselves as a community stock-held team. They made themselves a locally owned team, and so it is an ongoing source of literally hundreds of millions of dollars of wealth for Green Bay. The flip side of local ownership being anchored to place is that you don't get a catastrophe when that firm decides to leave. I work for a firm based in Maine called the Training and Development Corporation, and I started my work for them in 2002 when a paper mill shut down in Millinocket in the middle of Maine, laying off the last 1,400 people. This was not a locally owned business. It moved the mill to Canada, and when those 1,400 people were laid off, the unemployment rate over the next year in the middle of Maine was 40%, which was higher than the height of the Great Depression. That was the equivalent of a nuclear bomb going off in that economy. That kind of catastrophe does not happen in an economy that is largely made up of locally owned businesses. And I might say parenthetically that as you know, you in this larger region have tied your fate to a number of very large pharmaceutical firms. One of them is about to go through a major restructuring. You may not get huge cuts, but you might. The big problem is that it's all out of your hands. You have no control over it. The last point is higher standards. And that is to say that local is linked to socially responsibility. Because let's take the Green Bay Packers again. Imagine Green Bay was to pass a living wage ordinance. That means the hot dog sellers and the ticket collectors would all get $10, $11 per hour. Well, would the Green Bay Packers then pick up and leave? No. Because they are locally owned, they have to stick around. They have to adapt rather than flee. Well, that is the key link between local and socially responsible. That is, when you have a bunch of firms that are linked to place, you have, as a board, the ability to raise labor and environmental standards with confidence that the businesses will adapt in a partnership. Now, I will say that there is a lot of talk these days about the greening of Walmart and other box stores, greater efficiency vehicles, green buildings, and so forth. And you know, some of that is great. The problem with this, just to like put it in perspective, is that at the end of the day, you do not have control over a Walmart. When you have a local business that's putting out pollution or treating its employees badly, you have the ability to actually talk to management downtown at a coffee shop, at board meetings, and potentially have some impact. When you have someone with a distant ownership structure, that kind of give and take is fundamentally impossible. I also think that the more that we depend on long shipping routes, in the case of Walmart, we're talking 15,000 miles from China, in an era of peak oil and global warming, that to me seems fundamentally unsustainable. And then there's big questions about what are we trying to achieve with sustainability. I know there's some interest on the board about the natural step, so I did throw in this slide here because I think it's an interesting concept of sustainability. The natural step basically says we should try to minimize our use of non-renewable resources from the Earth's crust. We should minimize our use of synthetics and try to maximize our use of natural materials. And we want to do so in a sustainable way. And we want to also make sure that these things are socially sustainable. The Brundtland Commission 20 years ago came up with an idea about a sustainability that was somewhat consistent with those ideas. And they said sustainability meets the needs of the current generation without sacrificing the ability of future generations to meet their needs. I believe that that's an inadequate definition, and that if one takes many of the ideas that are embodied in Natural Step and much of the work that people are doing in communities, a better definition of sustainability is we want to meet the needs of our community without sacrificing the ability of other communities, present or future, to meet their needs. So it puts in an element of place, and that one's community's sustainability should not be at the expense of other communities. And that's one of the real problems with an attraction-based economic development system, because if you're just trying to attract businesses away from somewhere else, you're undermining other communities' ability to achieve their degree of sustainability. Second point about local firms. The key of economic development is the economic multiplier. The economic multiplier means that I spend a dollar at Weaver Street Market and people who work there spend it at the local farmers market and the people there then spend those dollars with local farmers. The more times that that dollar circulates in the community, the faster that it circulates without leakage, the more income, wealth, and jobs. That's economic development 101. Local businesses turn out to do that much better than non-local businesses. There was a study in Austin, Texas, 4 summers ago, looking at the impact of $100 spent at a Borders bookstore versus $100 spent at a local bookstore. $100 spent at the Borders led to $13 remaining in the local economy. $100 spent at the local bookstore led to $45 remaining in the local economy. So in multiplier terms, the local business contributed 3 times the wealth effects, 3 times the job effects, 3 times the tax benefits. We're not talking about small differences here. To put this in a more modern context, something that was done 3 months ago, there's Iowa State looked at the job impact of an ethanol plant. Build an ethanol plant with no local ownership and get 140 jobs. But if you have up to 73% local ownership, the multiplier comes from that more than doubles the number of jobs to over 300 in the state of Iowa. So again, it's not a small impact when we talk about the importance of localization. And let me go back, because the reason for this is pretty obvious. There's been a dozen of these studies done internationally. They all point in the same direction. The numbers vary a little bit from study to study, but they point in the same direction because local businesses spend more of their money locally. I mean, that's a no-brainer. In the case of the 2 bookstores, the Borders bookstore doesn't have a local management team. The local bookstore did. The Borders bookstore did not use local lawyers and accountants. The local bookstore did. The Borders bookstore did not advertise on local radio and TV and newspapers. The local bookstore did. The Borders doesn't have a local profit stream that comes in. The local bookstore did. Just those 4 factors could be 15 or 20% of the aggregate expenditures of that business. And you can see across businesses why it's always true that the local business will be a contributor to your economic well-being. So number 3, Lois turns out to comport with cutting-edge economic development theories. Now, I'm happy to say that there have been, you know, multiple discussions in this community about goals for economic development. And the terms that come up again and again are things like smart growth and having a cool downtown and having a creative economy. Well, guess what? All three of those things are much more consistent with small locally owned businesses than non-local businesses. Let's talk about each of them. Smart growth. You can't have a walkable community with a gigantic industrial park. It just won't work. And if you really want to create walkable communities, you have to think about how do you create a creative mix between commercial, residential, where people literally can walk from one thing to another. It's not going to happen with big box. Cool downtowns. This is the insignia of Keep Austin Weird. You might choose a slightly different set of symbols for Carrboro or not. But if you think about it, I mean, what is it that draws people to a place? It's the cool places. You know, it is the Weaver Street Markets. It's the specialty nightclubs and restaurants. People don't come as tourists to places that are absolutely familiar to them. Now, this is also the reason why creative economies goes hand in hand with local, because local businesses offer entrepreneurship opportunities. And entrepreneurship means that the best and the brightest have real interesting outlets for all of that passion. I mean, and if you think about it, you know, communities that are rooted in jobs that are mostly checkout clerks or hamburger flippers or folks who are turning a screw on an assembly line, those are not going to be creative economies. Those are not going to be places where entrepreneurs and the best and the brightest go. Places that are rooted in small upstart businesses are going to attract the best and the brightest. So really, the only criticism, I think, that people can legitimately hurl at the local economy framework is to say, okay, all things being equal, local versus non-local, it makes sense to do local for the reasons you've laid out, but all things are not equal. We live in an era where bigger is better, bigger is cheaper, and that's why we can't go this local route. We simply can't force everyone to buy more expensive goods and services from non-local businesses. And the way this argument plays out, and you know, as one goes back to some of the older studies that Carrboro has done, you hear these things in certain of the passages. Local businesses are kind of part of the old economy, that old parochial part of the economy. It's past Eden anymore. Most local businesses fail. They're too risky. Most can't innovate. And they certainly can't compete. So let's talk about each of those. First, in terms of rareness, this graph here shows the breakdown of US GDP by the rootedness in business. And what it shows is that when you add together the half of the private sector that's basically small independent businesses and the 6% of the GDP, which is nonprofits, hospitals, universities, advocacy groups, and then the governmental sectors, you get 58% of the economy. All of those things are rooted in place. All of those things will never move to China. Well, that means the majority of the economy is local. Now, the truth is that when you look at an economy like Carrboro, probably the number is much higher. I'm guessing, I mean, I asked at dinner how many jobs here there were total. We were puzzling over that number. But I'm guessing that the number of jobs here in locally owned businesses is probably closer to 85 or 90%. And it starts to suggest why an economic development strategy that is not focused on those 85 or 90% of the businesses that are already here doesn't make a lot of sense. Now, what about the question, most fail? What you've heard is something different. Most small startups fail, of course. Most large startups fail. Most of all startups fail. But it's not true that most small businesses fail every year. In the most recent year in which we have data available, there were 32,000 more small business births than deaths, and 200 more large business deaths than births. Most small businesses can't innovate, hardly. 60-80% of all new jobs come from local small businesses, 13 to 14 times more patents. Most can't compete. To think about this question a little bit differently than you're used to, consider that every year the US government puts together a database called the North American Industrial Classification System, NAICS. And they basically try to create a mosaic, a picture of the entire economy of the United States. And they cut up the economy in 1,000 categories. If you ask the question, in how many of those 1,000 categories do we have more examples of competitive large business than competitive small business, the answer is a whopping 7. In 993 categories, we have more examples of competitive small business than large business. Now, what are in those 7 categories? Well, number one is running a centralized monetary system. And even though Carbro aspires to foreign policy and the like, I don't think you're going to be doing this soon. We can take that off the table. Number two is running a nuclear power plant. All right, maybe that's not your fancy. Number three of most centralized businesses is rocketry and guided missiles. And if ever there was a category that would be hard to localize, it would be one with an intergalactic mission. And yet, of these 10 businesses in the US in that category, 3 are small and locally owned. So it's an option. I'm not suggesting you go that way, but you have that possibility. We have a perception of globalization, and that perception is, you know, local businesses losing ground to Best Buy and Target and Walmart and Home Depot. What are we going to do about all of that? Now, just keep in mind that everything I just said was retail. And it's true that retail has really got taken a shellacking by these big box companies. But here's the thing that people forget, is that retail is only 7% of the US economy. The other 93%, local businesses have been doing quite well. And in fact, over the last 10 years, local business has only lost about 3 to 4% of its market share to non-local business. Now, that still matters, okay? I'm not discounting that. But I think it's important to ask the question, well, why is it? Was it because local businesses were not competitive? Maybe. Or maybe it's a few other things that we don't give enough weight to. For example, every single year, state and local governments, not your local government here, but your state government for sure, gives $50 billion a year in various kinds of booty to attract or retain non-local businesses. And the feds give approximately $63 billion. That's $113 billion of pork, the main mission of which is to weaken and destroy local small business. Here's another thing. By show of hands here, how many people bank locally with a local bank or credit union? So most of you. Okay. So by show of, so we got a pretty local crowd. So by show of hands, how many people have their pension funds invested in local businesses? No one. That's right. It's not an option for most people in most places. And there are reasons for that. We've got biases built into the equity markets that make it exceedingly difficult for us to put our pension funds and other investment funds into local small business. But think about how irrational this is. 58% of the economy is place-based. So roughly speaking, an efficiently functioning investment market ought to be putting 58% of the investment money into local small business. And yet, we are over-investing in Fortune 500 companies and under-investing in local business because of certain problems in investment laws, which I'd be happy to go into. Then there's a bunch of other legal things, all of which are biased against local small business. So let me give you some examples. Buy a book from a local bookstore, pay sales tax. Buy it from Amazon, no sales tax. If you're a big company and move overseas and decimate a small town like my paper company in Maine, you take a tax write-off for the moving expense. And then when you pay the new taxes abroad, you get a tax credit. So we've created a tax system that pays off to companies that betray their communities. These companies are all non-local. We have antitrust laws. 25 years ago, antitrust laws would have prohibited Walmart's model, particularly with respect to its suppliers. Today, we give them a pass. My point is that when you look at all of these things, the equity market biases, the biases in law and public policy, it's a miracle small business only lost 3% market share over the last 10 years. Or you put it another way, if we get public policy even half right in the next 10 years, you will see this small mart revolution. Now, I don't have time tonight to go into all of the reasons why small businesses are becoming more competitive. But I just want to give you one or two ideas so you know what I'm talking about. The first is that everywhere you go in this country, red state, blue state, checkered state, you find a buy local move. Restaurants, you know, we serve local food, local bank, local insurance company, family owned. I have yet to see anywhere a sign that says we are not locally owned, buy from us. And I don't think it's going to do very well. And consider this. This is, here's a very hopeful sign. Here is a golden arch, the words locally owned and some French fries. And it comes from a poster that's in the middle of National Airport, right underneath McDonald's. They put this nice little poster here to give you the feeling that when you eat your chicken McNuggets, you really are supporting your local economy. Or consider HSBC. They call themselves the world's local bank. Why are all these big businesses trying to get into the local act? Because they know you are going to prefer local purchasing for the reasons we just talked about. Here's another global trend. This is the price of West Texas crude oil from 1998 to the present. You can see it's gone down a little bit. Even an economist would have to concede that the price of oil is rising. That is bad news for some people. It's great news for local economies because we're going to do more energy conservation, which is inherently local. We're going to be doing more smart growth. We're going to be doing more local production for local consumption, because that's going to become more competitive as against Walmart production in China and 15,000 miles of shipping, even if the labor were free. There's a bunch of other trends that we don't have time to go into. Well, here's one I do want to mention. Global production is often very cost effective because when you go overseas, you know, you can pay someone a dollar a day or worse. But global distribution turns out to be a terribly inefficient deal, and you really see this in food. Back in the year 1900, when you bought a dollar's worth of food, 40 cents went to the farmer and the rest went to inputs and distribution. Today, 7 cents goes to the farmer and 72 cents goes to distribution. Distribution is things like refrigeration, packaging, middle people, advertising, things that have nothing to do with food. So when you're thinking about, okay, how do I create cheaper food? Well, I could have really expensive food, double the costs of production, organic, biodynamic, you name it. Let's say, so now instead of 7 cents, we're at 14 cents. But if I have a local distribution system like your farmers markets here that gets rid of most of this garbage, I have cheaper food. And it's the underlying economics that's driving these community-based food systems around the country. The same is true in energy, by the way. The same is true in telecommunications. In all of those fields, distribution costs have outpaced production costs, and there's going to be a leap in new local economies of scale. Now, I want to just draw a couple of thoughts about implications for Carrboro, and then we'll open it up for discussion. The first implication for Carrboro is, no matter what you think about doing, and you know, there is a long list of ideas that are on the table. If you put a local ownership screen on it and say that we should be focusing on locally owned businesses for smart growth, we should be focusing on locally owned businesses for creative economy and so forth, it will come into focus much more clearly. I would say, you know, one of the things that we forget is that, well, you think, okay, I can bring in one big box store and get a big bundle of money in sales tax and property taxes. But what is forgotten is that on a square footage basis, that box store will generate less than the non-local than the local store would. This is a study from Andersonville, a neighborhood in Chicago. And significantly, local impact per square foot of business. They looked at five different sectors, local versus non-local, and the local businesses produced far more impact in terms of tax collections than the non-local business. So local businesses matter for tax because more lowest sales will lead to more sales taxes, proportionately more. Lowest demand, that is the more we have demand for local businesses and those local businesses get up and running, they will occupy some properties and that will increase property values. And if we have local businesses with capital assets, personal property taxes can be assessed on those. Implication for Carrboro number two. A lot of the traditional location ideas in urban and regional planning are becoming obsolete. And they're becoming obsolete because more and more of the character of any given business is in its internet connectivity. And frankly, you know, and this is great news for a community like Carrboro, because you don't have to be the biggest community to be the wealthiest. We know that from college towns. You don't have to be centrally located near a port or an airport or a mineral supply or a bunch of ships. I mean, yeah, that was true 10, 15 years ago, but that's less and less true now, because almost everything can be done to some degree virtually. And frankly, you don't even need an office complex. And I'm going to come back to that in a moment. So in my view, a key thing for economic development is not to guess in advance what are the three or the five or the 10 businesses that are most valuable for economic development here. Frankly, the point is that you got 1,000 categories of business out there, 993 are potentially competitive at a very small level, and it's a mistake to cut yourself off from any of them. And that's why I think the most important things that we need to be focusing on are, you know, entrepreneurship, networks of businesses, mobilizing investment, mobilizing purchasing power, and making sure there is commercial space where needed for these businesses to form here. Implication number three. I know there is a long, agonizing discussion in this community about residential versus commercial. And there are a set of assumptions that residential costs a lot of money in terms of services, and commercial will bring in a lot of money. And there's some truth to that. But the point is that we are entering an era where those assumptions are getting all scrambled. I thought it was very interesting. In the RTS study, it said that of 1,000 creative economy workers in Orange County, 750 of them were working out of their homes. Now, those 750 people, you know, will they continue to work in their homes? Maybe. Some of them, though, may graduate into storefront businesses. And I suggest that there is a vast economy going on in people's homes, or about to go on in people's homes, that you are only dimly aware of. And this may be the industrial park revolution you're looking for without having to go through all of this new land use planning agony. And the good thing is that the more of this development that occurs within people's homes, the less parking problem that you're going to have as well. So to me, one of the key questions I would look at is, you know, to what extent are the existing economic development activities and zoning activities supportive of these home businesses or standing in the way of them? Where I come from in Washington, D.C., they do everything they can to destroy home-based businesses like mine. I can explain in details if we have time later. Implication for Carrboro number 4. I believe that you need to focus on inner development, not attraction. And, you know, people here have said, and they're right, no one here has engaged in the kind of, like, grotesque, you know, subsidization of bringing auto plants to Carrboro, and that's great. But what I worry about is that there are much more subtle forms of throwing your money away to attraction that you could get sucked into rather than just focusing on the nurturing of your existing and potentially existing small business community. As we were talking about at dinner, the fact that you have such a low vacancy rate in your existing commercial properties, much lower than the surrounding region, to me suggests the interest is already here. You don't need to stoke that interest even more, especially when you don't have the property to serve it. We know, without doing any exhaustive studies, that there are massive leakages in this economy. We know that probably 90% of people's retail purchases, of the people who live, are going outside the community. We know that only 8.5% of the people who live here work here, and a very large number of them like to work here. Now, you got lots of wonderful local businesses. But the problem is that you have to actually educate people affirmatively about what those businesses are, what they provide. You have to link those businesses together so that they become more competitive and supportive of one another. You have to buy some goods from them as a city every now and then in order to push the demand even further along. You have a great program in providing local loans, and that's terrific. But I think we need to think much more ambitiously about how do we take advantage of the probably hundreds of millions of dollars of pension funds that exist in this city and begin to funnel some of that to these local businesses as well. Just to leave you with a revolutionary quote from Patrick Henry, "Why stand we here idle? Is life so dear or peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains? Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me community or give me death." Thank you very much. Let's open it up for comments.